Welcome to Conscious TV with Tom and Ramon. Over a couple of real quick things right now. We have got a few things going on. We've got, I guess the contest is over now, isn't it, Ramon? So
yes, but we have a new contest, and we'll talk that about that a little later.
For our author tonight, we've got a couple of things that we're going to give away. We've got a lot of things going on the website. Check out the new Paradigm page. We always try to promote that. A lot of good things going on there. And also, if you've got any suggestions or comments on things that we could add or good ideas for this new paradigm that we're moving into, we would really appreciate you dropping us an email with your information. Ramon and I work on a donation basis solely, and if you feel compelled to and have the ability and means to, we do appreciate any donations you can drop our way. You can do that via our website, www.conscious-tv.com. And there you can find all sorts of interesting stuff. We've got quite an extensive video page, and all our archives are there from all our past shows that are free for anybody to listen to. So jump in and take a listen. Also, Ramon and I have offered our services as tarot reader and healing. So there is a page there for that also. So if you are seeking any kind of assistance or would like a reading via the tarot, feel free to jump in there and ask your questions. That also we do for free. All we ask is that you pay it forward. So, Ramon, who have we got tonight?
We have someone who's very well known, which the first time I heard of her was about, 2003? You might know her from What the Bleep. But Lynn McTaggart is an investigative journalist and author and a sought-after public speaker whose talks and workshops have transformed the lives of thousands around the world who have heard her. The hallmark of her work is exhaustive research that produces science-based discoveries in the world of science, spirituality, and health. She is also an accomplished broadcaster who has appeared on many national TVs and radio shows, including Oprah Winfrey and Deepak Chopra show. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, guys. It's really nice to be here.
Since you're an experienced broadcaster, maybe you can give us a few pointers, because me and Tom don't know what we're doing.
But
before we start, before we start, I want to give away your book, and it's called The Bond, which I'm reading through it now. We have two books, and the way you can win this book is the first two people to email us at info@conscious-tv.com gets to win the book.
And just put in the subject line, The Bond.
Yes. And of course, send us your address, and so we mail it out to you. So, Lynn, I want to start off by talking to you. In the beginning of the book, you talk about your daughter and how she basically lost a part in a musical theater for school play, was it?
Yeah, she was the lead role, and she had been given the part, and she was all set. When I went to see her in practice, she had been shunted to a more minor role, and I had talked to her about it, and I couldn't get the story out of her. And then I finally found out through a third party that her best friend, one of her best friends, had lied to take over the part that had been given to my daughter. And while I was watching it this one day, watching the rehearsal, her mother was there. And I had been, you know, shocked by this whole situation. So I tried to tactfully bring it up with the mother. And the mother kind of just bluffed me off and basically said, well, you know, that's life, isn't it? And I was just taken aback and shocked. But it got me thinking, and I thought to myself, well, yeah, that's the life that we adults have created for ourselves. You know, It pretty much permeates every area of our lives. You know, small wonder that it's going to end up in, you know, little small transgressions that kids do to each other. Because, you know, competition is really the very warp and woof of our lives.
Yeah, I was, when I read that, it just reminded me, and it's not surprising that we're in such the planet, such in trouble than we are, because we're so busy about just competing and winning, and really, you start to wonder what are we winning? Because, I mean,
full of the fittest mentality.
Yeah, once we leave this life,
it is survival of the fittest mentality. And as you say, it pretty much runs through every aspect of our lives. You know, that's, we think that we have to create businesses like this to, that we have to compete in order to be successful. We think that we have to compete with our neighbors, and we feel like, you know, we're always up against it. If they've got a Mercedes and we only have a Ford, we're pretty upset about it. We think our kids, the way to teach them excellence is to teach them to compete with each other ferociously, not just on the sports field, but everywhere. You know, so it just ends up permeating our lives, our relationships, our everything. And so my big question, I came away from that drama practice saying, you know, does it have to be like this? Were we meant to be so competitive? You know, is this the way nature designed us to compete? You know, this is what the scientists have always told us. We're separate and competitive. Is that right? And the resounding answer from, you know, I looked at physics, I looked at biology, I looked at psychology, I looked at anthropology and sociology, and the answer screaming back at me was no. Nature has designed us with a bond. And by bond, this is what I mean. It was evident to me that between subatomic particles, between us, our bodies, and the environment around us, between all the relationships and all the people we come into contact with, in all of our societal groupings, there's this connection that's so profound that the individual doesn't really mean as much. Things aren't really individual. Things are only meaningful in relationship. And so it's that connection that's so profound, you can't figure out where one thing ends and another thing begins. And that's how nature has designed us. And because we live a lie, because we live against this, that we go against nature, and that's why we're in such a mess. That's why we're in such trouble. That's why everything is ending and collapsing around us.
So I'm thinking about that, that space in between. I like the way the subtitle of the book, Connecting Through the Space in Between Us. I think about that, and I kind of see that space as being the catalyst for promoting that that survival of the fittest, or the separation, the polarity type consciousness, because we are aware of that space in between.
Okay, I see what you're saying, Tom.
Yeah, I don't know, going back to the Kali Yuga type thing where the cycle of our evolution, et cetera, but getting back to the connection between us, or the awareness of the connection between us.
Okay, well, what I really mean by this connection between us and the space in between is breaching that space. Understanding that the space in between isn't a space of separation, it's the very connection, it's the important bit. You know, what they're finding, let me put it to you this way, let's look at subatomic particles for a minute. Now, you know, we're always taught that subatomic particles are a little bit like billiard balls that revolve around the nucleus of an atom. But that's really not a very good analogy, because subatomic particles, when you get down further and further to the tiny bits of matter, you come up with nothing but air. You come up with a little bit of vibratory nothingness. And subatomic particles can't be known in themselves. They're only known because they're trading information, relation, and energy with each other, pretty much like an endless game of tennis. And so what you understand about a subatomic particle is it doesn't exist by itself. It exists only in relationship. It's only that trade that's the important bit. And that pretty much is mimicked through nature. The whole idea that the individual is really insubstantial, and the thing that matters, the thing that we were designed to have, is relationship. And that connection that we have in every part of our being and everything that we do and are is really the way nature created us, to care, share, and be fair, not to compete. And we unite, we succeed when we unite and we connect. We fail when we don't, when we compete. That's our problem now. That's the mindset that's changing in the scientific stories that are being told now.
Yeah, I'm absolutely amazed with the science that has come out just in the last 10 years, even on consciousness and the quantum fields, and they're just making some absolutely amazing breakthroughs. Being able to tie the consciousness into the quantum field is just blowing me away. I'm sitting here going, finally, science is saying, yes, consciousness has an effect on our reality. Yay!
Absolutely. I mean, we're now understanding how profound the connection is between mind and matter. You know, we're just beginning to understand that, and that's just the beginning of, there's the beginnings of sort of baby steps towards some sort of sense of how mind affects matter. And that was, of course, what I did with the intention experiment, that the plan was really to look at that and to find out how much mind and group mind can affect matter. But we're also seeing that in all sorts of areas. We're finding that biologically, we've always had this idea that we are individuals and that we are, that our bodies exist as totally separate entities with a blueprint that we have from birth, our genetic code. But the new evidence is showing that actually we get invented and assembled from outside in. This is what I mean by that. We understand we've got certain genetic code, but there's only certain things that turn on those genes. They get turned on or off by our environmental factors. So our diet, our water, our relationships, the sum total of how we live our lives determines whether genes will be expressed or not. So that bond we have with the environment is really what creates you and me, not anything that's intrinsic and inside. So we would not exist as we are if it weren't for our environment. And that environment, as I say, turns on what becomes you or me. So we get created from outside in.
That makes me think of that the experiment that you talk about in your book. I can't remember who did it, of the molecules that were lactose intolerant.
Yes. I mean, that was such an amazing experiment, wasn't it? This guy who, biologist, did this incredible experiment, taking bacteria and plunking them in, and this is bacteria, as you say, that was lactose intolerant, so it couldn't digest lactose. So he stuck them in a medium filled with lactose. Now, we'd all think, well, these bacteria are going to die and not reproduce because they can't, they're going to starve to death. But actually what happened is the bacteria started going into hyperdrive and hypermutating their genes so that ultimately a mutation came up that was able to digest lactose. As soon as they found it, as soon as the bacteria found this gene, this mutation, they snipped out the old gene and stuck in this new one. Now, that has unbelievable repercussions to how we live our lives, because if this is true, if we are actually responding to the environment that much, we're operating in cooperation with our environment, and our environment is changing us. It's changing our genes.
There was another scientist. I haven't been able to finish the book yet, so I don't know if you mentioned, but I read somewhere else. David, what's his name? I can't remember his name right now. But it was they did a test on what they're called, Anole, the small little lizards. And they took them out of the environment, a desert environment where they mostly eat bugs and insects and they're very aggressive towards each other. And they took them out of the environment and put them in a forest, in a jungle environment where there's a lot of plants. And what they found was that they were turning into vegetarians and they were getting bigger. Mm-hmm. So they changed completely. And I think it was in maybe one or two generations. They were even changing skin colors. I don't remember exactly because I'm getting this from memory.
But yeah. You know, we now know that that sort of thing is possible, that we are adapting to our environment all the time. And that, you know, there is this need to, you know, Darwin initially believed that we mutate by happenstance, and that those mutations, the ones that help a species survive, create the fittest one, are the ones that survive. So that metaphor basically says, it's more of a dog-eat-dog metaphor than another scientist called Lamarck, who believed that we had a cooperative relationship with our environment and that we went back and forth like this as a bond, changing in response to changing environments. And it looks like that is much more the case. We're now understanding it's a lot closer to that.
Yeah. I'm always wonder if between these energies that are, these new energies that are coming into our environment from man-made and also from outside the galaxy, and also the combination of people meditating, is that turning on different DNAs?
Well, that's an interesting question, you know, and it's one I've been trying to test with the intention experiment now for 4 years. You know, how far can we take this? We've run 22 experiments. What we've found is we can make plants grow faster. We can change essential properties of water. We've changed water pH. We've changed water molecular cluster structure. We've done an experiment, a peace experiment, and we've managed to lower violence, it seems. We're still, you know, we're looking at that some more to see if, you know, if we can repeat this. So our very preliminary evidence in these 22 studies is that things can profoundly change through consciousness and the nature of intention. Whether we can change people's DNA by thinking about it is another issue, but certainly we seem to be changing things outside of ourselves, and that's, you know, it's fascinating, and I would love to do more to see how far we can go.
So what is the power of intention, really?
Well, the power of intention, I think, is taking consciousness and focusing it on a particular outcome of change. And it's being conscious of consciousness. most of the time, we're not. Most of the time, we're just walking along, and we're really rattling along in our brains all sorts of thoughts. And those of us interested in intention usually think that if we have a single power thought in a day, that's going to be the one the universe hears. And the rest of the stuff we think, all the other flotsam and jetsam in our heads, isn't going to be heard. But, you know, we know from the science that we are radiating out little particles of light all the time, little tiny, a constant current of biophotons. We're sending out light and information all the time. And living things are sending light and information back. We know this from many, many scientific experiments. So if that's the case, you know, we are broadcasting all sorts of stuff all the time with every thought we have. So intention is, you know, sometimes intention happens when we're not really expecting it. If we have a positive intention in the morning for something, and then we spend the rest of the day thinking about how we're never going to get it, and how we're losers, and how we're, you know, we're muffing everything that we do, we send out that intention. That's what the universe is going to hear, even if it's not set per se as an intention. So, you know, we are broadcasting all the time.
Here's a question. With all the experience you've had and the experiment, is there any intention experiment that you've done on your own or in a lab that completely just floored you, shocked you, that you was like, no, this can't be real?
Yeah. The peace intention experiment we ran in Sri Lanka, we had a week, 8-day long intention, and we had thousands of people from all over the globe doing this. And we had a team of scientists measuring the outcomes and looking at violence statistics for 2 years before and creating a timeline to see what happened afterward. Now, during the week-long intention, violence quadrupled. It went up drastically. And I got really worried about this. I said to myself, oh, my goodness, you know, this is not working. So I was really fearful about it. But then the violence plummeted and it continued to, it went down to about 74%, it went down by. And we also saw that in that week, the government, which had been losing the war, ended up having a number of decisive battles, and it changed the whole nature of the war. And 3 months later, the government took back the north, which had been held by the rebel forces. And by that June, the war was over. Now, did we do this? You know, when you have one experiment, you have a very interesting experience, but you might not, you can't say anything definitive about it. But all the scientists, the team of scientists we had looking at it, said that certainly there was something very compelling about what happened, that our week seemed to have been pivotal in winning the war, and that there was a lot of evidence that activity of consciousness, there had been a real focusing of consciousness during that week. There's a guy called Roger Nelson who runs the Global Consciousness Project, where he has REG machines all around the world, and he is measuring what happens to these random machines when lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time. And he's found when there's a very emotional thought, let's say like when Princess Diana died or with the Twin Towers disaster, there was a huge veering away from random activity with these machines, suggesting that there is such a thing as this global consciousness. But then, when during our peace intention experiment, we also found that these machines veered off their ordinary course just in that 10-minute window when we were sending intention. So that was pretty mind-boggling for all of us, because it looked like we were having our, you know, a real effect that we could measure of coming together as a group. So that to me was mind-boggling. But the other thing that has been really mind-boggling, and this comes to a lot of my work that I've been doing with the bond, is looking at what happens when you group people together in small groups. And I've been doing this in a lot of my workshops, where I ask people to get together in a group of 8 or 12, and we have them send intention in each group to somebody within that group with a health challenge. And what we have found, and this was shocking to me because I hadn't expected it, was the people who get the intention are, by the next day, are profoundly better in the main. I mean, we had one woman with an opacity in one eye. She could barely see. And the next day she reported that her sight was completely recovered by about 80%. We've had people who had arthritis and could barely walk, and then we sent intention, and the next day they were kind of skipping down the stairs. It was remarkable. But then the other thing that blew me away was that the senders were getting better too. We had one situation recently. I did a workshop in Kuwait, and one of the guys receiving intention had a bad hip, and he got better. But then one of the people in his group who had also had a bad hip, he got better as a sender. So it's that kind of virtuous circle where everybody benefits, senders or receivers, everybody benefits. And I've also been surveying the participants. You know, I send surveys out after the big intention experiments, and I find that the people participating report big changes in their lives. They say, I'm feeling more open and loving of my friends and family, but most particularly, I'm feeling more open and loving towards strangers. So this power, the power of coming together in community, which is really the message of the bond, is something that's really our birthright and the thing that is not working anymore. We're breaking away from what nature designed us as. Nature shows that we need to belong. We need to share, care, and be fair, or we get into trouble.
So how do we change this perspective on a mass level?
Well, when I talk about the bond, is, well, you start small to make big changes. I talk about a variety of things in the bond. One is we have to change our perspective because we're so used to looking for the individual thing that that's all we can see now. And not all cultures see the same way. I mean, for instance, you know, we grow up with simple reading books like Fun with Dick and Jane, and they show individuals getting up to stuff, and they really emphasize individuality. In, say, Eastern cultures, let's say like the Japanese, other Eastern cultures, they have books that say things like Big Brother and Little Brother are sitting together. Little Brother loves Big Brother. Big Brother loves Little Brother. They're taught to value the relationship, the whole. And many Native cultures have that too. And so what happens is they can see subtle changes. They see the whole. They're able to embrace difference a lot easier than we are. During the 2004 tsunami, 250,000 people perished. But four Native cultures watched the whole thing from the top of the hilltop. And they were able to determine that this was going to come by very subtle means. Then when they were asked later, they said, well, we noticed the fish were swimming a little different. There was a little bit of change in the wind. And a few other things. The animals were acting a little strangely. And this told us that the waves were going to pull back and be unleashed with fury. And it's that kind of holistic seeing that I'm talking about, the ability to see the whole. So, you know, we're used to seeing things. We're so blinded by individuality that when we see things, we miss, you know, we have what they call inattentional blindness. But we can easily recover this. There are lots of ways. I mean, one very simple way I talk about in the bond is doing practices like mindfulness meditation, where you take certain times of the day and you just stop. You stop thinking about what's going to happen or what has happened, and you just come into the present and observe what's going on with your five senses. Now, we almost never do that. We're only focusing on probably one sense at a time, or maybe two. But if you, let's say you're eating your cornflakes, and you start focusing on what they really look like, how they really taste, how they sound as they crunch in your teeth, you know, the feeling of it as it cascades down your throat, the smell of them, all of that, all together, you will begin to notice more. I mean, there are many studies showing that after just a few weeks of practicing mindfulness, you start noticing much more subtlety in the whole. And the reason this is so important is for really our relationships, because, you know, what we look for always is similarity in other relationships. We look for people to be just like us, and most people aren't. And also, this is what's polarizing us now, not being able to step into that space in between. So if you're able to see the whole, you're more able to take aerial vision, to accept and to have a different perspective on things, where you're valuing the relationship, the connection, above everything else. And so that can easily embrace difference.
Nah. When you were saying that, it just made me think of a bunch of different things. One main aspect of that was that in a lot of cultures, it's important to go and sit next to a tree and be grateful towards the tree and talk to the tree. Or in a lot of cultures where they're from the jungle, it's very important to watch the birds and see, because the birds will tell you if there's a predator nearby, or you know, like the tsunami. Because I heard that too, and I heard that a lot of them watched the birds, and when the birds left, they left as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the birds weren't coming down to their normal area.
They noticed the hole. And, you know, this kind of perspective, taking this perspective of the whole, you start to recognize your effect on other things. You start to make bigger connections. You start to see yourself in relationship to a bigger entity, one great big intergalactic bond. And it changes your behavior. So that's one thing you say, you know, well, what can we do about it? Well, the first thing is a lot of little practices that I talk about in the book will change you, you know, really train your brain to look at things very differently. And by doing that, you start widening your ability to step into the space in between with anybody, with any background, no matter how different from you.
That's the key, isn't it? Getting people to actually start training their brain, training their thought processes to realize and understand that this is a reality. I think
Absolutely. Once
a person touches this and they start and they have that first experience, at least in my case, it snowballs, and yeah. You go, wow, this is real. And it starts growing and growing and growing. The synchronicities start happening, and everything starts the old world goes away.
Absolutely. It was fantastic, you know, to observe that. I mean, it doesn't take much. You can just do simple practices, and they can change your perspective completely on how to live in wholeness. So that's one thing. Another thing that's really important is also changing your view of relationships. Because as I said earlier, what we think about all the time is I need to have friends, and I need to surround myself with people who are just like me. And I can't really be friendly with people who are not like me. And that's what we always call connection, is just looking for I in other people, so that, you know, we make what we think is a superficial, you know, well, what we think is a connection is usually just a superficial connection of likeness, of like with like. But there have been many studies now and many examples showing that you can connect with anybody with just a simple change of perspective. I'll give you an example of this. There's a guy called Orlin Bishop, and he's engaged in what anyone would consider a fool's errand. He is trying to get rival gang members in Watts, California, to relate to each other in wholeness. Can you imagine what, you know, a futile gesture that is? But what he does is he gets these guys, you know, and this we're talking about the Crips and the Bloods, you know, just with who have been unbelievably violent toward each other. Gets some young men from both groups, gets them together in residential homes, and he teaches them to relate to each other differently. He basically teaches them an African practice called Suobona. Now, this was popularized in Avatar, you know, where the Na'vi say to each other, I see you too. Well, actually, it really is in Africa when they say with Suobona, they say to each other, we see you too, because they never consider seeing a solitary act. When you're seeing other people, you and your ancestors and all the people you around you are seeing too. That's how they view it. But basically what they're saying is, I'm here for you, whatever that needs, whatever that requires. And that's what Bishop is teaching his guys. When you speak to each other, talk deeply. Talk about what you really dream for. Don't talk superficially. Don't try to find likeness, because that doesn't matter. When you talk about what you really dream for, when you talk deeply with each other, what happens is the connection automatically unfolds. And when you are the listener, what you should be saying to yourself is, what do I have to be to help this person be what they need to be? So how can I be of service to this relationship, this connection? And once you've changed your perspective to that, you can easily embrace difference. It doesn't matter. Just a difference of opinion doesn't matter. You're connecting on a much deeper and more fundamental level.
So how does it, you know, in the world today, there's a lot of ugliness out there. And, you know, people go through personal tragedies, loss of a loved one, loss of your job, loss. How does a person deal with loss?
Okay, it depends on what kind of loss. If you're talking about just the loss of a job or whatever, I would say the most important aspect of any kind of loss is community. I mean, one of the things that we are collapsing into is a community-less society. You know, we used to be much bigger joiners than we are now. And we have the internet, but we don't have, you know, a lot of us don't have personal connections anymore. We have our immediate family and that's it. But so many studies show that we were meant to belong. We were meant to care, share, and be fair. And we're hardwired for this. Caring for us, doing for others, giving to others is as important to us as eating and sex. Belonging is probably one of the most important things we have. And it is the most powerful antidote to all sorts of illnesses, depression included. And so one of the first things is connecting. I mean, the science shows that any relationship is better than no relationship, and that connection can you know, there was a study once of a batch of people who were really suffering. They were among the poorest, you know, the most financially challenged in America, and they found that they were not depressed as long as two things happened. They had a strong spiritual source, but more importantly, that they had a strong community in their church. And so it was, sure, the spirituality was important, but the community was more important still.
Yeah, that you definitely see that if you go to third world countries, where you go to middle class America and you see people depressed of all sorts of things, or even especially here, you see that in Japan. But when you go to these really poor countries, you see everybody happy, smiling, and joking, and they have the one thing that you don't really have in big cities that are more wealthy, which is the community.
Yeah, and it's, you know, one of the reasons I wrote The Bond was because I wanted to alert people to how simple it is to recreate this, you know, because we think, as you say, I mean, I saw a story once where they had a native culture and they had Americans in some native town. And they asked the native culture, stand inside a circle if you've ever been hungry. And everybody got inside the circle and nobody got out, you know. And they then said, stand inside the circle if you've ever been lonely. And no one got in there. With the Americans, it was the reverse. Everybody stood inside the circle when they were lonely. No one stood inside the circle when they were hungry. So it was, you know, it was just the reverse, and in a way we're the poorer for it, because, you know, the science shows that belonging is probably the biggest antidote to disease. You know, it protects people against all kinds of things, including heart attacks, strokes, depression. Connecting even with bad relationships are better than no relationships. But in The Bond, I talk a lot about changing your perspective on relationships and how to do it, and how you can bring forgiveness, where forgiveness isn't just about saying, yeah, I forgive you. It's about really confronting the person who has hurt you, and you both talking truthfully about it. And what ends up happening is you untie the knot that has kept you from each other. But I also talk in the book a lot about reestablishing community and how simple that is. And I'll tell you that by way of one of the most amazing studies, I think, of psychology in modern times. It concerned a group of psychologists who got a bunch of boys together, 12-year-old boys from the Midwest, and sent them to a camp. Now, they went went to the camp, they were divided into two groups, and they traveled on different buses. They were given different living quarters. They were encouraged to create separate identities, separate names. They called themselves the Rattlers and the Eagles, the two different groups. They had different flags and hats and all sorts of things. And they were made to compete with each other ferociously. And the competition got fiercer and fiercer because the camp counselors, who were all psychologists in disguise, sort of made it so that they would always be neck and neck. So after a while, they didn't have to engineer competition anymore. These two groups were ready to kill each other, and they started to. They started beating each other up. They ripped up each other's flags. They, you know, they invaded the other's living quarters and trashed them. They were doing all sorts of stuff like that. They hated the other. So then the psychologists turned around and they said, okay, let's try to engineer some togetherness. So they created a series of crises in the camp that could only be sorted by the collective efforts of everybody working together in teams. So all of the boys, for instance, had to work together to remove a boulder that was cutting out the water supply. And they did all sorts of things like this. By the end of the time in camp, these two groups that had hated each other were best buddies. They wanted to travel home together. They bought ice creams for each other. They were now one. And all it took was the need for collective teamwork to achieve a goal that no one could achieve by themselves. That's called a superordinate goal. And that idea has been used to revitalize all sorts of neighborhoods, all sorts of organizations, and is the simplest way to get people who are of different opinions and backgrounds and ideas and religions to come together as one.
So in your book, you have a chapter called Surrendering to Wholeness. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is changing your perspective. You know, we always have this idea with relationships. It's about relationships. We always have this idea about relationship that what's important is to be right. What's important is to maintain my views at all cost. And we put that first. We put ourselves first in any drama. All it says is if you surrender to the idea of relationship, that what's most important is the relationship, not necessarily always having your own way, always being right, always having me, me, me. You change that relationship, you become available to do what you need to do to make that relationship and that other person thrive. When you just put that as your goal, differences melt away. I'm not talking about being a doormat. I'm not talking about surrendering any views you have, but just changing your perspective about what's important. You know? I mean, they always said that great line, don't sweat the small stuff because it's all small stuff.
Right.
You know, that's just having that as your idea is what's most important is the relationship. You take that into any position and you can embrace differences. For instance, this guy called Mark Gearson, who works in areas of conflict, and he was working in Palestine with the Israelis and the Palestinians. He worked with an organization that had members of both camps working very effectively together. And he said to them, how can you do this? And they said, easy. We can live with paradoxes. He said, what do you mean? He said, okay, well, let's take the establishment of Israel. So a Palestinian wrote a paragraph about it first. And he called it the disaster. And he talked about how terrible it was, you know, the Israelis had taken over and pushed out the Palestinians, and they had lost their homes, etc., etc. Then it was an Israeli's turn, and he wrote the Historic Day of Independence as his title. And he talked about how Israel had been given this sanction by the UN, and it was brilliant. They got their birthright back for the historic place. It was back to theirs. But from that moment, they had been beleaguered from all sides, and they were bravely defending themselves. And, you know, the tragedy is that both versions are true. They're both right. They're absolutely both right. So when you understand that, you understand there's more than one version of the truth, you can live with difference. It makes it so much easier to step in that space in between where you find common ground and you find the effect of your actions. So in my book, I provide a lot of ideas about the bond. How do you make the bond with someone else? How do you forgive someone who has transgressed you? How do you untie that knot?
Yeah. Wow. Tom?
Well, I want to segue a little bit and pick your brain on some of your own personal opinions on a few things. Afterlife, the reincarnation, how do you stand there?
That's an interesting question, Tom. I did some work on that in my book, The Field. There's certainly a lot of evidence, particularly for children who are who have picked up information about people living before they could not have known any other way. And there is a guy, Ian Stevenson, at the University of Virginia, I believe, who collected this information and really, you know, categorized it. And it was very compelling. Here's my take on this. I don't know if it's a case of people living again in a different body. What I think is this. I think consciousness never dies. I think when the body dies, consciousness decouples from it and just returns, in a sense, to the field. And you know, I've talked about the brain as being a receiving and sending mechanism rather than the repository of information, that our brains are a little bit like a television set and a television station all at the same time, that we're picking up stuff. And that what might happen is that, you know, children, particularly children under five, they're almost living as though they were on a hallucinogenic drug all the time. You know, when they're that little, they are, you know, they're in an alpha and delta state in waking consciousness. They are, you know, they're hallucinating in real life. And it's not far-fetched to think that because they are so close to these extrasensory experiences, that they could be just be picking up the wrong bandwidth, so to speak, when on their radio receiver. And they pick up somebody else's information in the field. So that's my take on it, to be honest.
Hmm. Interesting. I've actually considered that paradigm myself. I have a pretty strong feeling of the life after death thing, but, you know, I don't know for sure. So I don't close any doors and haven't closed any, I'm still seeking the truth on that, I should say.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's it. There's, you know, it's going to be really difficult for us to know for sure. How can we know for sure unless, you know, unless we die, and when we die, then we see. But you know, we can have theories based on some of the information that we see, and there certainly seems to be some compelling evidence to suggest us this.
Yeah. As far as the scientific research, I read. What was it? I read it. I can't remember at the moment, but that people who are constantly meditating have a tendency for the gray matter in their brain to grow. And people who... Did I read it in your book, or was it... and people who are schizophrenic, for example, the gray matter in the brain tends to be completely gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if I've... I don't know about that, but I can tell you about... one thing I've seen about meditation, it changes the structure of the brain. You may have read that in the intention experiment. Just a few weeks of meditation, even if you are a novice meditator, will enlarge certain areas of the brain, depending on what you're meditating on. It will, you know, if you are meditating on helping people, on compassionate meditation, sending out intention of compassion to all things, the I can serve part of you, the happiness part of your brain, and the can I help you part of your brain grows very quickly. If you are focusing on intention and intention meditation, the focused part of your brain for intention grows. So your brain is this kind of plastic thing that grows depending on whatever thoughts you have.
Yeah. There's certain people that I've met, and they, when you were talking earlier in the show about how people's always sending and receiving, there's certain people who've been meditating a long time, and this one gentleman named Khan that I've mentioned on the show many times, when I met him, his energy is so strong and so loving that it's like he, how can I say, he himself is bringing your vibration up and heating you in a way. So when you were saying the whole thing about people who send their intention to heal somebody else end up healing themselves.
Mm-hmm. The ripple effect.
Yes.
Yes.
The splashback,
yes.
As Tom likes to call it.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think that that's an interesting thing. And I think that comes back to the point of the bond, too, that little actions can have a ripple effect in the world. I mean, one of the things that I was really most amazed about was to see how much we affect other people by pay it forward activities. I mean, scientists at Harvard have shown that when you do one act of kindness, it can affect your friends, your friends' friends, your friends' friends down a network. They've actually studied this scientifically. And I'll give you an example of this. This can happen very, very quickly and easily. And so if you do some act of kindness, say in your office, it can change the whole culture of the office. There was a woman, for instance, who decided she was going to do this with her daily Coke during her coffee break. She left the change in the Coke machine, and she left a little note that said, your Coke has been bought for you. Pay it forward. And this blew everybody around her so much. They didn't know it was her, but they were dying to figure out who's the secret Santa. So they started setting up basically a neighborhood watch scheme where people would go around to try to figure out who was this woman doing this. So at that point, she decided, rather than be figured out, she started escalating operations on another floor and leaving donuts every morning. And these little simple acts changed the whole culture of that business. People were coming home, they were chatting about it, they were talking about it, they were fascinated, and it had a huge ripple effect in the company. And it's that sort of small thing that can have an enormous ripple effect. Or the superordinate goal I talked about earlier, just doing something with your, you know, creating it in your business, in your company, or in your neighborhood, a little goal you can all get together to try to affect for the common good, where it needs everybody working together. We have this in my neighborhood. We had a cell phone company that wanted to put 8 cell phone towers around our village, and we were up in arms about this. But our neighborhood then got together and decided to create basically a housewives brigade, where we would pass around leaflets, we'd get people to sign petitions, we'd talk to our local government, etc. And we basically chased away one of the giants of business, of British business, doing this. We prevailed. But more importantly, our neighborhood came together and became closer than it ever had. It was a way of revitalizing our neighborhood, and we found the soul of a neighborhood we never thought existed.
Yeah.
So we're running low on time, and I want to give you a chance, because you're going over to America and to where you're going to be at and how people can get in contact with you and how they can find your book.
Okay. Well, thank you. They can find my book and order now by just going onto our website, www.thebond.net. I also have a series of programs I'm going to be offering for people to find out how to take the bond into their lives. And I will be in America. I'm flying over on the 22nd of April. I'll be in Pennsylvania. And then I'll be over in the Pacific Northwest for until May 7th. So I'll be in Seattle, Bellingham, Mount Vernon, Vancouver, Portland, and Boise. So to find out more about my schedule, just go to www.thebond.net and have a look at my schedule. And we can, you know, I hope to see some of you there.
Yeah. We've also got, we'll also have her schedule posted on the website in the archive page too. So if you want to take a look there. Also, we'll have links to her website and links to get her book and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera there. So.
Yeah. Wow. So what would be the closing statement that you would love to say? If people threw everything else out you said, what's the one thing you want them to remember the most?
Okay, the one thing I want everybody to remember the most is simply that, you know, we're all in despair right now because we watch America and we feel it's broken. We see the world, we feel it's broken. We feel like our Congress isn't doing anything. They can't work together, Democrats and Republicans. We feel, you know, many of us feel, you know, well, why are they all waiting? What's happening with our president? Why are they not doing something? And we feel very small. But the point is, we have much more power than we realize. We have the power. Small instigators, science has shown, can make big changes and change a whole culture of selfishness around. And what it needs is just starting to say, it doesn't have to be like this. It starts now. It starts here with me and you. And one of the most powerful political statements you can make out today is, you go out there and do something kind for that neighbor you never spoke to. You go out if you're a Democrat and hug a Republican today. If you're a Republican, you hug a Democrat today and step beyond and into the space in between and watch what happens and watch that ripple effect around the world.
Right. If you want change, be the change, right?
Absolutely. And it doesn't take much to be a big change.
Well, Lynn, I want to really thank you for joining us today. It has been quite enlightening. So, wow. I suggest everybody go to our website and pick up The Bond. It's a very informative book. So,
yeah, and she explains the science very well. So even if you're not a big science person, it's very easy to understand.
Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate those comments, too.
Okay. Well, thank you, everybody. www.conscious-tv. And just drop by the website. Remember, we've got a couple of the copies of The Bond that we're going to be giving away. So drop that email and reference The Bond, and we will drop it in the mail to you.
We're only giving away two, so if they didn't win them yet...
And Condemnation Without Investigation, The Height of Ignorance. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Good night.